divorce. Even thinking about getting a divorce can be overwhelming, scary, and sometimes exciting. Join divorce coach and mediator Mandy Walker for conversations about divorce. The more you know, the easier it will be to make your divorce healthier, less stressful, and to put it behind you. Here's Mandy.
Welcome to Conversations About Divorce. I'm Mandy Walker. Today, we're talking about how to know when it's time to end your marriage. We all know, I think, that relationships need care and nurturing to make them last. And certainly most of the people I've worked with and talked to about divorce didn't get married thinking that they would get divorced. And the decision to end their marriage, it's not easy. People often agonize over it. They agonize over it for years, and they don't want to get it wrong. So how do you know when enough is enough? How do you know when things aren't going to change for the better? So those are questions that I don't have clear answers for, but my guest today is here to help us with his amazing insight on this. My guest is Jed Diamond. He's one of the world's leading experts on midlife relationships and the author of a book called The Enlightened Marriage, The Five Transformative Stages of Relationships and Why the Best is Still to Come. Welcome, Jed.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you.
I'm glad you're here, and I know I'm kind of asking you to turn it, your focus in your book is about marriages, keeping marriages working, so I'm asking you to change that around a little bit and help us to figure out when, as I said in the introduction, when enough is enough. I thought we could structure our conversation around some of the most common situations that I hear about and I have clients approach me about. One of them is when there's chronic, severe mental illness. And oftentimes I've found that that's where it's untreated, where the party who does have the illness is not following treatment plan or is not willing to go into treatment. And there's a tremendous amount of guilt around ending a marriage for somebody who's sick.
Indeed. Yeah, I think that's certainly one of the reasons that relationships break up. And part of that large area of mental illness, I think, includes addictions of various kinds, alcohol abuse or drug abuse. But there is that ambivalence because people have an understanding that their partner may be disabled in some way or sick in some way, and yet they're miserable. The marriage is, you know, often very destructive. But the guilt that so many people feel of not being able to work things out, particularly with somebody who may need help but isn't getting it. So it's a very, very difficult edge, and one I, as a therapist who's been working in the field for 40-plus years, is one I deal with all the time, of helping people find out what's right for them. And sometimes even when somebody's sick or mentally ill, and you know they need help, but if they're not willing to get help, sometimes you have to leave in order both to take care of yourself, sometimes your family, and ultimately the person themselves, that sometimes leaving is what allows the person to really get how difficult a situation they're in, and sometimes that's the impetus they need to get help for themselves.
Yeah, and that's so frustrating for the person who does leave or says, I can't do this anymore. We need to end our marriage. And then they see the other party start to make changes that they've been begging them to do for years.
Exactly. Yeah, I try to help people live. I think this is probably good support for anybody who ends a relationship, to give yourself time, whoever ends it, to really take a deep look at yourself, about the whole relationship and history, to look back into your past to see what you can learn from it, and rather than jump in very quickly into another relationship, to really feel and understand what you've been through, to be able to heal the trauma of it, and also be able to recognize that sometimes it takes an actual ending in order for a relationship to come back together. And that was one of the things I discovered in, you know, the work that I did, is that often a relationship is at a certain critical place and the partners pull apart and it looks like things are over, but it's actually a stage of a relationship that can be healed and can be brought back together. And I've seen, you know, in my practice, quite a few relationships that came back together even after, quote, they ended and the couple had separated or even divorced.
Right. Well, let me just go back a few steps to, let's take an example of a couple who, where one person does have a mental illness. I mean, how do you counsel the person who comes to see you who is healthy and says, you know, I just don't know what to do. I am at my wit's end. This is awful. There's some really crazy behaviors going on. This is not a healthy environment. But, I'm married and, you know, I'm committed to him or her. I mean, how do you counsel somebody through that?
Well, just to give you a context of my counseling, I've been on both sides of the counseling practice. I was married twice and divorced twice and went through all the things you go through in trying to decide and see if a relationship could be worked out. And I was a counselor. I thought, you know, I certainly should be able to work things out and my relationship shouldn't end. But it did, and it did twice. And I had to do some real soul searching about why and what to do and whether, what I needed to learn. Fortunately, I learned some things, developed some, you know, some new understandings and skills. And my wife and I have now been together, our third marriage for both of us. We've been together now for 37 years. So, I know both sides of that. So I can help people really understand, you know, how do you deal with some of the large issues that pull people apart? Mental illness, you know, certainly is one. Physical illness is another, as people, you know, get older. And I don't think there's so much difference between physical illness and, quote, mental illness.
I was going to ask you about that.
We know now that, you know, things like depression, things like alcoholism, things like anxiety, you know, disorders, you know, the whole range of what we think of as mental illnesses, bipolar disorder, which is called manic depressive illness. There's a physical component as well as a, you know, a psychological and an emotional component. And what I found is, as is true of so many issues that pull couples apart, and is why, you know, why I wrote the book I did, was that I found that too many marriages really came apart that could be saved if the people knew what was really going on and how to treat it. As you said in your introduction, nobody really wants to get divorced. They want to try to heal whatever's going on, and they only get divorced when nothing seems to be working and things seem to be getting worse.
Right. So in my example of somebody who's struggling with a mentally ill spouse, what would you counsel them to do?
Well, one general thing that I've counseled, and it's in a way is counterintuitive, is that many people that come into my practice come in saying, what can I do to get that other person to change, whether it's because they're mentally ill, because they're drinking, because they're angry a lot, or they're abusive, or they say, I love you, but I'm not in love with you anymore, or I don't love you anymore.
Right.
And they come to me saying, my partner is troubled. You know, what can I do for him or her to get them on track? And my general rule of thumb is saying that the change that's going to make things better is going to come first from you. You being willing to make the changes in your own life and be able then, as a result of you changing something, you learning something about what you need to do, often that's what then triggers a change in the other person, as opposed to saying, all right, I've got to get them to whatever, fill in the blank, get into treatment, get help. And often the other partner gets more resistant. The more you try to get them to change, to get help, the more they dig their heels in, because nobody, you know, if they were going to change on their own, they probably would have done that. So I've developed a change process that, in a sense, is a little bit counterintuitive. It's how to get the other person to change by you changing something in you that needs to change, that's waiting to change, that's wanting to change, but your preoccupation with the other person has gotten in the way of you taking action that you could take to make things better in your own life.
Right. So I like your point there about it being counterintuitive, but it goes to that point, like, you can't make someone else change.
Exactly.
You can only control yourself. So if you started to work on yourself and kind of explore maybe ways that you were creating the environment in which they could continue that behavior, I mean, there's no guarantee of a happy outcome there. There's no guarantee that the outcome will be to stay married. Once you start working on yourself, it might create such a breakdown or such a gap in your relationship that it almost accelerates the ending process.
Well, what I find, and I'm sure you found this too, is some relationships really are beyond repair. I have actually 10 different indicators that people, I suggest when people come to me, are indicators that the relationship may be beyond repair. And everybody's different, obviously. There's no foolproof saying, well, if you've got 9 of these 10 or 7 of these 10, then you should move on. But it helps me when I work with people to get at where your limit point is, where your point that says, you know, I just need to move on with my life because this doesn't seem to be getting better, and I've tried, you know, various things to make things different, and they're getting worse or they're not changing. So I kind of help each person really find what's the message in the crisis. I believe every crisis is trying to tell us something about what's going on in our lives, whether it's a medical crisis, an emotional crisis, or a relationship crisis. And what I found is if we can help people find the message, find the wisdom in what is this asking of me? What do I need to be doing that I haven't been doing? What do I need to be seeing that I haven't been willing to see? That allows people to break free of some of these patterns that keep people locked in to either dysfunctional relationship patterns or patterns that either keep them locked in when they should leave or locked out when they really should be able to stay and work things out.
That's good. I like that every crisis is trying to show us something. And I've of late have started to think when I find myself in a difficult situation and my gut is like, it's like, oh my gosh, I wish I didn't have to deal with this. I've started to try and tell myself, no, you are exactly in the place where you need to be right now. And this is happening for a reason. And there's something that you need to learn from this.
Right.
So
I think of it, I tell my clients most of us have kind of a movie romantic view of marriage. You find somebody, you fall in love, you think, we finally found the right person, you go through that initial falling in love stage where everything just seems to be falling into place and be wonderful, and then we hope that things deepen and love goes deeper and we live happily ever after. And what I tell people is that that's not really what marriage is about. I said that marriage really is more of a hero's journey, a vision quest, an opportunity to go on a journey to deal with, you know, the inner demons that need to be dealt with, the inner dragons that need to be slain, the dark nights of the soul that we need to confront. And when we see marriage more like that, it helps us to recognize that it isn't all sweetness and light, And if it isn't sweetness in life, it doesn't mean there's something so wrong with the marriage that it needs to end. I think we have this, you know, kind of naive view of what marriage is about, and those people, you know, I consider myself among the naive ones, and that's what I thought in my first two marriages that lasted, you know, 5 and 10 years, and, you know, luckily I've learned that what marriage really can be, and when you understand the depth of what that journey is about, I think you can have a marriage that has lots of ups and downs, but deepens and is deeply satisfying, you know, for, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60 years, hopefully.
Wow. So, in your 10 indicators that you run through when you're working with a client about a marriage being beyond repair, can you share a couple of those, maybe one of those, and then we'll go for a break?
Sure. You know, one of the we talked about physical and emotional violence is present. That's, you know, one of the ones that I say, you know, if the relationship has gotten where the person is either physically violent or what I say emotionally violent, where they may not be physically abusive, but you constantly feel you're in the presence of somebody who has lost their ability to be caring and compassionate and really, you know, seems to be in a place of being hurtful. And sometimes, you know, that's one of the indicators that tells me, you know, maybe this is one thing we ought to really look at that may indicate this is something that's gone beyond the level where it can be repaired.
Right. Yes, that seems to be like a key one that's probably pretty easy. Am I making an assumption here if I say that's pretty easy to spot?
Well, certainly the physical abuse is easy to spot. I think the emotional abuse is, you know, and you kind of alluded to it when you're dealing with somebody who may be, you know, mentally ill or very, you know, I work a lot with angry men, and I'll have, you know, women will say, hey, man, you know, he gets explosive, he gets irritable, he gets angry. I wrote a book called The Irritable Male Syndrome, where I talk about that anger edge that can be so hurtful and destructive and, you know, can lead to violence, or it can just be emotionally destructive interactions that, if isn't understood and dealt with, can really destroy the emotional bond that a couple may have with each other.
Right, right. No, yes, I agree. The emotional control or violence, as you term it, is not always obvious. And it's not always obvious to the person who's the victim of that. And I've seen people, as they've kind of worked through the divorce process, start to realize just how much they were being controlled without being aware of it.
Right, exactly.
So let's just take a short break. I'm Mandy Walker. This is Conversations About Divorce. And today we're talking about how do you know when it's time to end your marriage? My guest is Jed Diamond. Jed is one of the world's leading experts on midlife relationships and the author of The Enlightened Marriage, 5 Transformative Steps of Relationships and Why the Best is Still to Come. So, Jed, I wondered if you could share with our listeners a little bit about your book, and I was going to ask you, is it ever too late for someone to read your book?
No, I have people read the book at every stage of their, you know, difficulty, from, wow, things are kind of, you know, some bumpy things are relatively good, but a few bumps I'm concerned, to, you know, things look really bad and I'm feeling like maybe we need to seriously look at ending, to a relationship that's already ended and you're starting to go, well, how do I know how to understand what happened so I don't repeat the same mistakes? How do I choose a better partner next time? How do I work things out. So I think everybody often, once they get out, they breathe a sigh of relief, but often get back in a new relationship before they've fully understood what happened to the old one and learned some of the things they need to learn to make the next one better than the last one. So I give people support and understanding at all these stages, from beginning to even after the end.
Great. Yes, and I can see where, like, even if your one marriage has ended in divorce, and maybe it's even more important for you to read your book so that you, as you say, you can make some different choices next time around.
Well, exactly. We know that, you know, probably 80 to 90% of people who have been through a divorce remarry at some point.
Yes.
So my kind of main thing is to teach people what they can learn to understand what did happen, and then what are some of the skills they need to learn to make a better decision the next time, and then to understand, you know, I say there's five stages, and I think we all know the falling in love stage and the deepening marriage stage. What people don't understand is there's a third stage I call disillusionment, where we become disillusioned with the marriage. We feel that we're with somebody that we just seem incompatible with, and often that's where most marriages split up. And I teach people what we need to do at that stage, how we can understand it, why disillusionment can be a good thing, and why that stage can ultimately be a source of healing, where we can go back often to treat some of the trauma and wounding that occurred in our families of origin, where we grew up, that often are like little time bombs that impact our later love life, that really isn't part of our relationship love life with our partner. They're actually unhealed wounds from the past that blow up in the relationship and cause problems later. So I help people understand this third stage so that they can go on beyond it, hopefully to the fourth stage, which I call real lasting love. And then the fifth stage, where couples can use their new sought skills in relationship to make a better world, to teach and be more loving in the world in all our relationships.
Right, right. Well, it sounds like, I mean, certainly for my audience, that third stage of disillusionment is probably where a lot of them are. Let me go and ask you about another common situation that I hear about from clients and from my readers, and ask you about what indicators you would use there to assess whether the marriage is beyond repair for that one. And that's the one where there's lack of physical intimacy. And and I know that, and I just want to say, I hear that from men and women. It's not just women,
right.
And it's not just men who are concerned about the lack of physical intimacy. It is a complaint from women as well. So,
right.
Is it true to say that if someone's saying that they're too tired on a regular basis, that it's always a sign of something else going on? Is there more to it than just being tired?
Well, being tired is obviously a code word for a lot of different things.
Right.
You know, it can be a code word for I'm no longer sexually attracted to you. It can be a code word for I'm just working so hard, I just don't have enough energy, and, you know, whatever is going on stressfully in their life. It can be a code word for I'm having problems with erections, or I'm having problems with pain on intercourse. And I don't know how to say those things to my partner. I don't know how to deal with them. So we begin to avoid sexual intimacy. And, you know, in a sense, the easiest thing to say is, oh, I'm just exhausted, I'm tired. It always means something. But the meaning comes out when we engage and we're able to, you know, talk honestly with ourselves, with sometimes a counselor, sometimes a close friend, and hopefully with our love partner.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you're the party that doesn't want to have sex, do you think people always know the reason why they don't want to?
I would say it's the opposite. I think most times people don't know the reason. They might even think they know the reason, but when, you know, we go deeper, we find out, oh, there's other things going on. There are things that, you know, are complicated. There are, you know, things that maybe, you know, even below our consciousness. It's a feeling of just lack of connection or lack of, you know, touch, or we just don't feel, you know, in sync with each other. So, you know, the sexual, you know, bond is fragile. And particularly as we get older in our lives where, you know, we don't have quite that, you know, that youthful enthusiasm to mate. And so that there's more things that can throw off that balance. And hopefully, you know, with some love and understanding and willingness to look at what may be going on, you can get at the root of it and be able to fix it before, you know, it leads to more serious disconnections in the relationship and blaming and feelings of, you know, that my partner doesn't love me or care about me, and then, you know, the things get more hurtful rather than more helpful and healing.
Because that lack of physical connection creates... it can compound and become it then becomes difficult to talk about it. It's difficult to clear the air for other conversations. So it becomes a barrier to intimacy in general.
Exactly.
So
yes.
Do you think, from what you've seen, are couples able to tackle this problem on their own?
Well, some can. I mean, part of the reason I wrote the book was to give couples, in a sense, a handbook. You know, it takes them through. I kind of hold their hand and walk them through the steps that I learned in both my disillusionments and the marriages that fell apart, and hopefully what my wife Carlin and I have learned in 37 years together, and then what I've learned as a counselor who's been counseling couples for more than 40 years. So some people, you know, if you give them a guide and both people are motivated, you know, you can walk through it. I have a course, an online course that I offer people that they can get where they can kind of take themselves through it, and many couples, you know, need some additional help and counseling support or coaching support that gives them some additional safety and a container and hopefully a guidance from an expert who's, you know, been over the territory many times and can understand things that the couple may not see or may not be able to easily work together on.
And I think on this topic, this particular topic, it's one where... The party who is withdrawing from physical intimacy and from sex is maybe really reluctant to seek outside help, to go to a third party. They may be like very, very private, find it really embarrassing to talk about this topic. So having resources that they could use on their own, if they're able to access that, if they're able to bring themselves around to doing that, could be very valuable for a couple in that situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what I would offer to your listeners, a couple of things that might be helpful is I'd be happy if people want to write me and email me, be happy to send them the full, you know, 10 indicators that a marriage may be time to end, and also, you know, some of the information on how you get through that third stage disillusionment for those that are struggling at that stage and trying to decide whether, you know, they can get some help to get through it or, you know, it's time to leave. So I'm happy to send that to any of your you know, listeners that would like to email me.
That's great, and I will be sure to put that in the show description. So and I'll get your email address and put that up on the page so that listeners can go there and get that, because I think those would be great resources. So we've got about a minute, 2 minutes left. I did want to touch on another situation that we mentioned briefly, and you do talk about this in your book. It's the one where one party says, "I love you, but I'm not in love with you." And that seems like, to me, it seems like they're trying to be kind and about this and the way that they're feeling. They're trying to be gentle, but it's, but what is the difference between no longer loving somebody and still saying that they love them?
Well, I think most people have a confused understanding. I think one of the things that it means when people say, I love you, but I'm not in love with you anymore, the in love usually is some remembrance of the passion that they had, the feeling of, oh, God, I just so want to be with you. And it can be a time of when the sexual energy was really high and the sexual interchange was really good. But now they've gotten to a place where things seem either dull and boring, or they're into that stage 3 of disillusionment where there's still an emotional bond. They still may care about their partner. They still may actually feel love, but they don't feel the passion. And so we help people deal with, you know, how to revive that and understand it. The other thing is people think, I believe, that once you are in love, it's a process that will always be there. You will feel it all the time. And what I've discovered and what we know from, you know, more scientific research that we've been doing is that love is actually an active engagement. It would be like when we first get married and have a marriage feast. Nobody thinks, well, we've had the marriage feast, we don't need to ever eat again. We understand you need to eat every day. Well, love is like that. I think love needs to be engaged regularly. It's not a one-shot thing you do when you fall in love and then you live happily ever after. We need to do things and exchange intimacies all the time in the same way that we need to eat regularly. If we don't do that, you know, we're not going to feel love, because love needs active engagement in order for it to stay alive.
So, and as you were saying that, well, the words that came to my mind was it's the care and feeding of a marriage, rather than, I dislike that term, like you have to work at a marriage, because it seems like...
I agree.
You know, yeah. Life shouldn't be, I mean, that's sort of part of your life should be somehow,
right.
It shouldn't feel like work. But I totally
It should be care and feeding. It's exactly the right analogy, because we should enjoy eating, you know, and eating a good meal and, you know, sitting down and really enjoying a feast. Well, same thing with love. If we're able to nurture and feed it, and, you know, I talk about how do you do that? You know, how do you actually create those day-to-day moments of care and feeding that keep love going and keep love always being nourished? Because love is like, you know, also a plant that you might have that needs nourishment. If you don't nourish it, it's going to dry up and die.
Right. So, Jed, you've been wonderful. I love all these insights, and you know, I still have a bunch of questions for you, but we're out of time. Do you have one more tip that you could share with our listeners, for like particularly for people who are trying to decide whether they should end their marriage?
Well, the thing that I would leave your listeners with, and like I said, I'll be glad to send them, you know, a little detailed look at the stage 3 disillusionment, because it's a stage nobody thinks of as a stage of a good marriage. We think when we seem to become incompatible and we seem to feel like, you know, is this all there is? Is there, you know, something missing? Did the person that I thought I loved, did they disappear? It actually is an invitation to go deeper. And I would just offer that as a little mind reflection. And there's much more that I could help people see when you're in that stage, how to understand it, how to navigate it, and how to get through it to what I call real lasting love, which is, you know, people have reported it's better than anything even they had in that first two stages of falling in love or deepening love. The love on the other side of disillusionment, you know, is love like nobody knew existed until they went through it to the other side.
Well, that's a wonderful message to leave us with. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jed.
My pleasure.
So, listeners, Jed has written extensively about relationships, and his most recent book is The Enlightened Marriage, The Five Transformative States of Relationships, and Why the Best is Still to Come. It's available on Amazon, and if you're struggling with your relationship, I encourage you to get a copy of it, read it, and see what you can learn from it. I do also want to say, I know how difficult it is to make a decision to end your marriage, and I would just urge you to take your time about doing that. Don't do it in a rush. I see people who, because insurance companies provide for 3 visits with a counselor, they go to see a counselor, they don't feel that they're making progress, it's not quick enough, and so they give up. They think that marriage counseling has failed. And I want to just say there that if you've been married for any period of time, if you've been married 15, 16, 17 years, you can't expect those problems. You can't expect to go to a counselor and expect those problems to really get to the underlying issues and then to talk about strategies for handling them. You can't get to that in 3 visits. So be realistic about what it's going to take to look at your marriage, figure out what's going on, and to work on it. And it certainly sounds like Jed's 10 indicators of when the marriage is beyond repair would be a useful resource. So I encourage you to take a look at that. I want to thank you for listening with us. I'm Mandy Walker. This is Conversations About Divorce. I hope you'll join us next time for more conversations.